Welcome to the Advance Your Art podcast, where we talk about the journey from artist to entrepreneur and everything in between. You've worked hard to hone your craft. Now take it to the next level with tips, techniques, strategies, and routines used by successful artists to grow their businesses and careers. Now, let's get started and have some fun with your host, Yuri Cataldo.
Welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
Perfect. Thank you for having me.
Of course. It's my pleasure. Thank you for taking the time to chat with me. I'd like to first start off with by asking you to describe yourself and what it is that you do.
I have a pretty weird set of skills in that I am an economist who, aside from that dimension, is also an entrepreneur. He's also an investor who specializes in exotic assets like domain names and occasionally cryptocurrencies. And I take these really weird and different skills and combine them into the kind of perspective that I think you cannot find anywhere. And I share that perspective with people through the videos I publish on my One Minute Economics YouTube channel, through the books I write, through the blogging I do and have been doing for the past 8 years or so. So that's pretty much it. All of the personality tests I take label me as the teacher kind. So I guess it makes sense.
Sure, sure. So at your heart, you're a teacher, and you just choose different areas to do that. I can see that.
I get my fulfillment from that. So I do get a great sense of accomplishment from any situation, video, audio, text, of course, in which I can share experiences, thoughts, and so on with others. So I would label me as a teacher for sure.
Okay, that's great. So there is definitely a mixed bag that we're going to be talking about today then. I'm curious, is there an important thing that you learned growing up from a parent or a teacher or a mentor that had an impact on what it is that you're doing right now?
I would say that the biggest influence in my life and the person who thought me to be kind of like a well-rounded, balanced individual was my great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. And basically, this is the kind of thing I like to put on the table, and I tell people a lot of times that you're not going to come to me to find earth-shattering advice in each sentence that I finish, you know? The value I give to people, the value of my perspective, I think comes precisely from the fact that in everything I do, I give it a well-rounded approach. I give it a coherent approach. And I like to think of it as basically giving people a dose of common sense that not many people provide these days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great. I always love to joke that common sense sometimes is a taught trade. So having a good dose of common sense is wonderful. Okay, so let's start from the beginning then. Could you walk me through the journey of, you know, your first – so obviously you're an economist, so you went to school for that. So when your early days as an economist, through your first few jobs, and what led you to why you decided to blog?
Well, the strange thing is – actually everything about me is strange, starting from the fact that I only once had a job, and it was more of a freelance job than anything. And I actually quit college, and you couldn't even say I quit college because I never went there. I got accepted, but then I just didn't go because I thought, okay, it's time to start businesses. My family was not doing great financially. You know, my mother got sick. It kind of sucked. So I said, okay, I'm going to let this college thing slide and just focus on running businesses, focusing on doing my own thing, being my own person, and so on. And I did that. So that's the strange thing, and that's what got me to basically combine economics with everything I do, is the fact that I didn't start on a well-defined path right from the beginning. I chose this path, and I started college again when I was already doing well financially. Now, realistically speaking, financially speaking, opportunity speaking, and so on, I had no reason, no practical reason to start college again. But I did it because I loved economics. I said, look, I want to learn more about this stuff. I want to teach others. I do want to make economics a part of my life. And I think it does say a lot, because when you choose to go back to college to study economics, and I went from dropping out of college to getting my bachelor's, getting my master's, going after the PhD and doing the whole shebang, so to speak. And when you go through all of this and choose to do it at a moment when you're comfortable enough, you would have been comfortable enough to just continue along the path you were on, then it means you're really passionate about it. And this is the kind of relationship I have with economics.
Mm-hmm. With your background, the fact that you've done so many different things, what was it that attracted your attention for each of those? So with domain names and with cryptocurrencies, is there something that you found that's related between those that piqued your interest, or what was it about getting involved in each of those that made you want to pursue that?
Well, at the very beginning, I did this entire internet thing. I always knew I wanted to be my own person. I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I kind of always assumed that I'd probably never do the regular 9-to-5 gig, so to speak. So I believe that what attracted me the most to this kind of life was the freedom it gives you. You know, the freedom to do your own thing, the freedom to set your own hours, the freedom to make your own mistakes, of course, and so on. For me, that was the main selling point. And it was never, and it still isn't about the money. I mean, the choices I make right now, you know, writing books, publishing videos on YouTube and so on, these are not the kind of choices that someone who's after money makes. You know, let's just say there are better ways in this world to make money than being a teacher, so to speak. And what I value most about the internet in general is the freedom. What I value most about my life is the freedom, because if you were to, you know, film a reality show around me and so on, you would notice that I don't really place emphasis on stuff, you know. I'm always the guy who drives a far cheaper car than one he can afford. I'm always the guy who likes being frugal, even if it would be possible for him not to, because that's the value in what I do. That's the value in what those who earn a living online do. The fact that you can basically, you can just take charge of your destiny. You can do what you want, when you want it, and for the reasons that you want to do it. That, for me, is the main selling point of the internet by far, and the reason why I'm going to be eternally grateful for being able to do something that generations before me would have never dreamt of it.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into then, I believe it's what you started first. Was it your blog?
Oh, no, actually, no. I started doing something straightforward. I started offering services as a freelance writer. I started by writing articles in English. That was the first thing I've done. Okay. And after that, I moved to what I think was, you know, a natural progression. I started my own business offering services. And obviously, the first services I started with were, once again, articles in English. But this time, I wasn't writing them myself. I was working with other people and acting not so much as a writer, but as an entrepreneur, editor, and so on. Mm-hmm. Then we progressed to other services, and I started having, friendship-like and even genuine friendships with some of my customers. And this brings us to an episode when I was chatting with one of them on Skype, a customer who ended up becoming my best man at my wedding. Mm-hmm. So we were chatting on Skype, and he was telling me, this was, I think, 9 years ago, he was telling me he's a professional domain investor. And you would expect me to raise an eyebrow, because you don't hear this occupation. You don't hear about this occupation very frequently.
Right.
But I didn't raise an eyebrow, because to someone who was pretty connected to the internet in general, it made sense. You know, domains are an integral part of the internet, so it made sense to me that the very best domains should be worth a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So we talked about domains. He told me a thing or two about what he did, and I started investing some in some as well. And fortunately, it turned out I was pretty good at it, because by far the biggest moneymaker for me has been the domain industry and everything surrounding it. So we were talking one of these days, and he was telling me about his blog, a blog that he started. It wasn't a good domain. He wrote some good content, but he didn't have time for it. And I have no idea what I paid him for the blog in question. But it was pocket change. Realistically speaking, he didn't ask me for a lot of money. He just saw that I enjoyed the idea of taking over, so I did. And this was 8 or 9 years ago, and to this day, I'm still doing it. I'm still, for the past few months, I've been blogging each day. And even if I don't blog each day, I do try to blog at least, you know, 2-3 times a week and so on. So even now, 8-9 years later, running a blog and sharing my thoughts that way is, I would say, it's an important part of my life.
I'd like to backtrack just a moment to talk about your domain investing again, because that sounds really interesting. So what is it that makes a domain more valuable than like one versus the other? Or is it a process where you would just buy domain names and then try to sell them off? Could you just go into a little more detail about what domain investing involves and what it's about?
Yeah, actually, the fundamental thing about the very best domains is that they sell themselves. So if you take a look at the business model of the biggest portfolio holders in the world, you will never find them actively looking for people to buy domains. Instead, they just accumulated vast portfolios of really the best of the best in terms of domains, and they're waiting for people to contact them. You know, it's kind of like a virtuous circle, if you will. Mm-hmm. You have the best possible domains. Obviously, they're good enough so that people contact you themselves by searching the Whois details of the domain name or contacting you otherwise. And of course, when they are contacting you first, you're in a strong position to negotiate, because it's them who want something that you have. It's not like if I contact you, it's because I want you to buy something from me. You're the one who's contacting me. Therefore, I'm the one who's negotiating from a position of strength. This results in obviously even more money that permits them to buy even better domains, which put them in an even better position to receive offers. And that basically describes, I would say, the careers of the very best domain investors.
Okay. What makes a domain valuable? Like if you were just looking at like a couple of domains, let's say they're not like an obvious thing, like, you know, you didn't own McDonald's.com before it happened. But like nowadays, is it
first of all, yeah, it's important to say that domains like McDonald's they're only valuable because they have been turned into a brand by something.
Right.
Okay, they do have some inherent value, like McDonald's being shorter than please buy our cheap burgers.info. But other than that, most of the big brand domains that we know and that don't actually mean something, the main value lies in what has been done with them, not necessarily the fact that the domain itself is amazing.
Okay. So looking apart from that, do you still buy domains? And if you do, what is it that you look for that may give you an edge on the domain that you're trying to buy?
Well, my fundamental compass is the fact that I try to only buy the best of the best. I'm not sure if you know this, but as of 2014, if memory serves me well, a lot of new domain extensions have appeared. Mm-hmm. So up until that point, you only had .com, .net, .org, .tv, .info, and just a handful of extensions, basically. Mm-hmm. Today, you have about 1,000 or so. You have anything. You have, believe me or not, you guys, our listeners, can search for that online as well. if you want to buy domain name .horse, you're going to be able to do that because there is an actual .horse extension. I kid you not. Wow. And furthermore, if you want to buy legal domains, if you're a lawyer, you can buy domain name .lawyer, domain name .lawyers, the plural, domain name .attorney, domain name .attorneys, domain name .law, domain name .esq, and these are actual examples of extensions that exist right now. So I'm sure you imagine just how much confusion is out there.
Yeah.
So personally, if anyone's watching, it's what I do. It's what I would recommend to absolutely anyone out there. If you're going to buy domains, buy the best of the best. And the best of the best means the very top meaningful .com domains. In my opinion, I for one, especially with all of the confusion that is out there, I believe in staying away from anything that is not .com.
Okay. Okay, great. And is that – so with your domain names, is that what the subject matter of your blog started off with or with your blogging –
well,
how did you start that?
To this day, I still primarily blog about domain names because, you know, that's what my target audience wants and so on.
Right.
But I do have a great platform in that I have an entire industry that's listening to me. And this makes it possible for me to talk about other things that I consider meaningful. So if I think that there's something wrong with current events in the world and so on, then I love the idea that I have a platform of people who are listening to me whenever I have something to say. And the same way some of my readers ended up becoming interested in the things I'm teaching about on the YouTube channel, so in economics in general. They're also – a lot of them bought my book and so on. But the blog itself, it's still to this day a blog about investing in domains, but it gives me the opportunity to have people – to have a voice basically. This is perhaps the most important thing to me. This is why I blog, why I write, why I publish YouTube videos. It's a privilege and sometimes a burden because, you know, the things that you say, the more people are listening, the more the things you say carry a certain weight. But the idea of having a voice, the idea of, you know, someone like me from the middle of nowhere, from Eastern Europe, having a voice and interacting and selling books to people from the US, from New Zealand, from Australia, from Africa, and so on, it's ridiculous. You know, if you think about just how weird in the grand scheme of things, just how weird it is that we right now are having this very conversation, it's just spectacular. It's truly a privilege that nobody else aside from our generations has had so far.
Mm-hmm. With your YouTube videos, how did that – because I watched a few this afternoon and they're really good and really informative. And I like how they're short and to the point and the animation is great. What was the process on, first off, you deciding that you wanted to make short economics-based videos? And how did you go about setting all of that up?
My primary driver has been the fact that just looking around me, I've noticed that, you know, my friends, my family members and so on, the average person has an absolutely awful economic education. And this is because when they were taught economics in high school, for example, or even those who went to college and studied economics, it was clear to me that economics was not taught properly. And it was taught in a way that drove people away. And that's just plain wrong because economics is all around us. You know, you might not know, you might not invest in anything. You might hate the idea of investing in stocks and think that, no, I don't want to make economic decisions. But by merely deciding to keep your money in cash rather than in stocks, you're already making an economic decision. So the main aspect I want to get across is the fact that whether we realize it or not, we're making economic decisions each day. And sometimes economic factors affect our lives in truly meaningful ways. Like, for example, a financial crisis, it can ruin lives if you're not ready. And you cannot use the fact that, yeah, I never cared about economics, so just Mr. Financial Crisis, please ignore me. That's not going to work. A financial crisis is going to come whether you're ready or not, whether you studied economics or not. So these are things you cannot run away from, so to speak. Now, this doesn't mean that everyone should be able to write a PhD thesis in economics. No, But it does mean that absolutely everyone, regardless of occupation, needs to know his basic economics. There's just no way around that. So, okay, I said, I'm going to do my best to teach these people economics. So I started with simple stuff. I started with explaining what inflation is, what deflation is. Then I moved on to covering more complex topics and so on. I've even covered fractional reserve banking, derivatives that helped, quote unquote, helped cause the financial crisis and so on. Mm-hmm. And as time passed, I've noticed that it works. You know, I have people each month. I come across at least a few people who come on my channel and comment and say, oh my God, I always thought economics was so hard, and it was always the subject I knew nothing about, I wanted to know nothing about, which some of them hated it, because it was taught in such a boring manner. And they tell me, that, oh my God, I'm watching your videos, and I never realized this complicated thingabajings can be so simple. And that's how it started. That's what fueled me. You know, the project ended up as me just, you know, kind of treating it like a hobby, thinking that, okay, I'm going to publish a video maybe once a month or so, and so on. But people loved it, and time passed, and more people appreciated it. And it didn't start out as a project meant for economics students. But I have to say that a lot of my traffic comes from students, from people who actually went to college and are studying this stuff. And you know what's strange? That students have told me the exact same thing that regular people have. That, oh my God, if you just simplify economics, if you just focus like what I'm doing on explaining rather than making students memorize definitions that they forget a minute after the exam, mm-hmm. then it's going to work. I love things that work. And a lot of times, simple things work, and I can achieve more by getting people to watch one of my one-minute video than forcing them to stay in class for 2 hours and not wait 2 hours that seem that they're not going to end soon enough. You know, mm-hmm. The main difference is the fact that the former works and the latter doesn't. That's what keeps me going. You know, the fact that economics works. And the results are starting to be seen, and not just among regular people, not just among students, but for example, I think 11 or so days ago, I found out that a college professor from the biggest university in the United Kingdom will be using my videos in her classes. So the videos are genuinely starting to make their way into classrooms as well. And it's just ridiculous, because all of this started out as just me saying, I'm just going to play around with this a bit. I think I can provide value. Let's see what's going to happen. And what happened is that, you know, I basically found the system, a system of teaching economics that works. That's all there is to it. It simply works.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's wonderful. And like I said, it's having watched your videos this afternoon, they're great and they're very informative. And you're right. They're like, it's little nuggets of information that are very easy to digest, and they make clear sense. I'm curious then, when did you decide to write a book about finance?
Well, I have decided to write a book that nobody else thought about writing, because if you think about it, how many people would you say make money online in one way or another? So if we were to add all of the freelancers, all of the domain investors, web developers, cryptocurrency investors, online entrepreneurs, and so on, my best guess that we're talking in the millions. Like, and it's a number that keeps growing and growing and growing. And this type of person, I have noticed over the years from being involved in so many projects and talking to so many different people who make money online across so many different industries, you cannot help but notice common denominators, patterns, things that people who make money online have in common, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And here we have an audience of millions upon millions of people who have a lot in common, a lot more than people realize, but nobody thought about writing a book that teaches primarily those people how to be smart with their finances. Time and time again, I've noticed that people who are extremely smart, smart enough to make a lot of money on the internet, ended up squandering it all. And they didn't squander it because, you know, of some complex scenario. They squandered it because they didn't have their basic economics straight. So by writing the it's obviously the best book in the world about the topic because it's the only one.
Right.
It's the only personal finance book out there written for the millions of people who make money online and who, to a very large degree, don't have their basic economics straight. Mm-hmm. And I make it clear in my book, the main reason why I've written it is the fact that time and time again, I have been shocked at how smart people, brilliant people, people who were smart enough to make money online in the first place, ended up losing it all because they didn't have at least some very basic financial education. And this is what brought me, this is what made me write Wealth Management 2.0. The fact that, strangely enough, a person with my ridiculously weird skill set was finally in a position to put all of these skills to good use. Because unlike most economists, you know, I can genuinely say that I relate to my audience because I'm one of them. You know, I'm not some kind of economics scorgy university professor who's sitting in his ivory tower looking down upon everyone and not understanding his audience. I do bring a good balance on the table by, on the one hand, having the, you know, economic credentials it takes to be taken seriously as an economist, but on the other hand, being involved in so many online industries has made it possible for me to connect with my audience in such a way in which I have a hard time believing that anyone can match. You know, I've been a freelancer myself. Mm-hmm. I've been a web developer myself. I've been a digital asset investor myself. I publish YouTube videos myself. If there's I've run even hosting businesses. I've seen the entire internet under the hood, so to speak. So this kind of this weird set of skills and life experience makes me, I've decided, capable of meaningfully and credibly telling people that, look, I think you need to have basic sound financial education, and I'm going to provide it through the book I've written.
So in your book, then, what are in your opinion, based off of your own, you know, your research and what you've done, what are some solid financial things that freelancers and people who work online can do that will make sure that they don't suddenly squander all of their money?
Well, primarily you have to have a coherent and logical approach. Like, okay, here you are, someone who makes decent money online and so on. And like you said, he wants to become better. Where does he start? Well, he starts not by learning what he should be doing, but by finding out first and foremost what he shouldn't be doing. Like, if I have someone who smokes 3 packs of cigarettes each day, the first thing I tell him is that it's important in his case what not to do. Because you're not, if you want to give health advice to someone who smokes 3 packs of cigarettes per day, you're not going to tell him to eat an orange or go jog for a mile. You're going to tell him why it's such a bad idea to smoke 3 packs of cigarettes. In the same way, in my book, before giving people the tools they need to, you know, build their own portfolio, to figure out what to invest in and so on, I've taken the most common and dangerous mistakes that I have noticed are made particularly by those who make money online. And I told people, this is where you have to start, by seeing, by identifying these mistakes and avoiding them. And a lot of mistakes are so misleadingly tricky that is just ridiculous. I'm not talking about just the obvious, oh my God, you shouldn't spend all your money on a new Mercedes Benz.
Yeah.
I'm talking about, you know, sometimes even the things society encourages to do are wrong. Like, for example, spending everything you have and becoming a financial slave by getting a mortgage for a huge house you cannot afford, but with which you want to impress your neighbors. You know, it's stuff like that that misleadingly creeps in on us and keeps us from making what are essentially simple financial choices. And I tell people in my book, time and time again, that you can have two identical, almost identical individuals with similar skill sets, with a similar job, a similar family situation, and so on. So Bill and John can be 55-year-olds with 2 kids each and who worked as freelance designers. Yet at the age 55, one of them might be financially independent, financially secure, with enough money set aside to send his kids to college, whereas the other can still be debt-ridden, living contract to contract, and so on. And this is what people have to understand, that the difference between the two is frequently in life, not the fact that one of them was brilliant and the other one was stupid. The difference is just, in a lot of cases, the fact that one of them made the right financial choices in a few, literally a handful of situations throughout his life. Mm-hmm. And this is what people need to understand. First of all, you start by figuring out what needs to be avoided. Then you start in chapter 5, I tell people, I like to call them the virtues of wealth management that they should be embracing. And in that section, I primarily guide them through mindset-related issues, you know, what kind of a way of thinking I'd encourage, stuff like that. And as you've seen, I don't start by telling people, okay, invest this much in stocks, this much in bonds, this much in real estate, and thanks for buying my book. Yeah. I take it, again, this is most of the value that I'm able to provide. Mm-hmm. Okay, one dimension is my experience and actually knowing my audience, but the other dimension is that I put a balanced perspective on the table and I give people a coherent plan. Start by figuring out what the mistakes you need to avoid are, then continue by deciding which mindset you're going to adopt as an investor. And only then is it time for us, which of course I've done in the book, to analyze various asset classes. And once again, something that sets me apart from most economists is the fact that you're going to find information in my book, not just about stock, bonds, and traditional assets. I also have an entire section about exotic assets, domain names, websites, cryptocurrencies, peer-to-peer lending, and so on. Mm-hmm. I've covered them in detail, but again, there's a time and a place for everything. And I think most of the value in my book is the fact that I give people a coherent, logical, and relatively easy-to-follow path.
In your book, and I don't know if maybe you covered this in your book or probably other parts of your videos, but obviously in helping people with mindsets, one of those challenges is fear. In your own life or maybe in your own teaching, how do you approach fear and or teach others to approach fear and overcome it?
Strangely enough, I've written remarkably a lot for an economist about fear in my book, and it's really funny that you're asking me this, despite the fact that we never had a conversation about anything like this before. Mm-hmm. I actually have an entire consistent section in my book about how to inform yourself, because to be a good investor, you have to be very good and balanced when gathering information. And I have a section about, you know, mainstream media outlets, how they frequently feed you misleading information and so on. So I have a section that talks about the threats of mainstream media, but I have a section which also talks about the threats of alternative media. And in that section, I cover the fact that on the internet, there's an entire industry of fear mongering, you know, the world's going to end, doom and gloom and so on. And I would say that as an investor, having the right attitude towards fear is important. You know, as an investor, you cannot afford to live in fantasy land and become kind of like a mindless consumer that mainstream media outlets would frequently like you to be, because you buy the stuff that's advertised on them. You know, it's obviously what's in their best interest. So no, that extreme should be avoided. But at the same time, this doesn't mean you should become Chicken Little. This doesn't mean you should hide under a rock and watch videos about financial zombie apocalypse each day, you know. In my book, I teach people to find the right balance. So I address that kind of fear, the fact that, okay, you shouldn't be a mindless optimist, but then again, you shouldn't be a doom and gloomer either. And I also talk about the fear of having skin in the game, of making choices, of making financial choices. This is a fear you have to overcome, and you overcome it by embracing, I would say, a healthy attitude towards failure. Because I'm sorry, but if you've developed the habit of being depressed each time one of the assets you have exposure to goes down in value, then you're not going to make a very good investor. You have to, you know, in my book, I believe I've done a good job of helping people, you know, understand that as an investor, as a balanced investor, especially, there are going to be losses. You're not going to always be able to pick the winners. There are going to be times of prosperity, times of calamity, and so on. But at the end of the day, it's all a matter of mindset, you know?
In your own work and in your own business, because obviously you spend a lot of time writing and analyzing, how do you manage your own time? Are there routines or rituals that you have, or how do you know in your day what you want to focus on at various times that keep you productive?
I would say that in my life, at least, the key is doing what makes me hungry. The aspect that set me apart, especially at the beginning in all of my projects, was the fact that I was always willing to bend over backwards for the dollar that other people were too lazy to pick up, you know? Mm-hmm. So why did I do that? Because I was hungry. I wanted it so much. I wanted it. I loved everything about it. I wanted it. I knew it had to be done. It's the kind of hunger that gives you an edge over other people. And productivity-wise, let me just say that when I work on something related to that deep hunger I feel inside me, I'm multiple orders of magnitude more productive than when working on things I kind of sort of like, but not really. So I would say the most essential productivity tip I have for people, and it's a tip they don't come across very often, is simply to do what makes them hungry. And it's primarily the reason why I've decided to write books, why I've decided to publish videos on YouTube and so on. It's certainly not about the money. I could make a lot more money just focusing all of my energy on, for example, investing in domain names. But the thing I, for one, am guided by, my compass is to a large degree influenced by what makes me hungry. Investing in domains, that puts money on the table. That puts more money on the table than writing books, than publishing YouTube videos. But does it make me hungry? Does it still make me hungry? And the answer is no. The type of satisfaction, fulfillment, and hunger to become better, to do more, that I feel when writing a book or working on my videos or generally speaking, being a teacher, as I've said at the beginning of this interview, it's precisely this type of hunger that sets me apart. So do, for the love of God, do whatever it is keeps you hungry. That is my number one productivity tip by far. Mm-hmm.
If you were to give advice to someone who was just starting off, and let's say they want to be a writer and kind of do what you do, what advice would you give them about starting off or kind of real world information would you tell them about what it is to have a day-to-day job as a working writer?
Okay, that's a tough one. So first of all, I would say that if you are thinking about becoming a writer for the money, if you have bills to pay, families to feed, and are counting on that money that you're going to make as a writer to make ends meet, then my number one advice for you is don't. Just don't. Writing is not something that's going to pay well in the beginning. Writing is not something you should be doing for the money. And let me just say that if your main concern is financial in nature, there are better ways to reach your financial goals than writing books. Which brings me to my second scenario. If it's something you're passionate about, if it's something you enjoy doing, and if you are financially, especially, it would help a lot. If you're also financially comfortable enough to be able to just focus on meaningful writing, on writing that you don't do to pay the bills. Because that is the kind of writing that has the most impact. That is the kind of writing that you are most passionate about. If you're going to be a writer, I would definitely focus on that, because in my career, I've noticed a lot of people who churn out content and treat writing as if they're as if they own a factory, so to speak, you know, a factory which churns out words. For example, I'm a member of perhaps the most popular forum among writers on the internet, and I frequently come across people who say that they write a novel once every 2 months. Now, let me just ask you, what kind of a novel can that be? You know, what kind of an epic, drama-filled, meaningful piece of work can a novel be that you finish in 60 days? That's the problem I have with a lot of writers and with the world in general, so to speak. The fact that you have people with attitudes like those, and I'm sure they have valid reasons, you know, again, families to feed, money to make, and so on. But I would, if possible, advise people against embracing business models which revolve around, okay, I'm a factory, I have to churn out 6 novels a year. That is something I wouldn't recommend, especially if you want to stand out in this world. Mm-hmm. And this is a world in which the average individual is bombarded from all directions with information. Everyone wants your attention. People on YouTube, people who are writing books, everyone is desperately competing for a minute of your attention, so to speak. And most of the information that's circulating out there is noise. You should not be the person who writes 60-day novels. You should be the person who writes, you know, meaningful stuff, stuff that touches people, stuff that genuinely triggers deep emotional reactions and so on. So if possible, my number one piece of advice would be this. Write from a position of strength. Write from a position which allows you to do what you love. If you make compromises, again, I'm going to understand it. But the likelihood of standing out as a writer is pretty slim if you focus, again, just like with domain names, focus on quality over quantity.
What would you say is the best advice you've ever received?
That is a tough one, but it's a quote I never heard from anyone else, and I tried to Google it and I didn't find any other source for it. But one of the most popular domain investors ever, it's a guy who started out in the 90s, who's genuinely kind of like a legend. And he remembered this piece of advice that he received from a boss of his when he was young, and which goes like this. If you see John Jones with John Jones' eyes, you will sell what John Jones buys. And it's so ridiculously simple and simplistic, and your first reaction might be to disregard it, but so much in business and life, in investing, in writing, and so on, revolves around seeing John Jones with John Jones' eyes, deeply connecting to him, deeply understanding him. You know, there's a world of a difference between a personal finance book written by an economist who has no contact with his audience compared to one written by someone who is a part of his audience, who is, you know, in my case, it's someone who makes money online. For other books, it can be something else. But it's precisely this celebration of human diversity, of the fact that, no, John Jones is not like me. John Jones is John Jones. And if I want to meaningfully get to know John Jones, then I'm going to have to make an effort to get out of my comfort zone, to venture out of my bubble, and to make an honest effort, which most people don't, to see other people through their own eyes, to embrace other viewpoints, to get to know other people. This is perhaps the main value that the internet gives us. You have 6-7 billion John Jones who are, potentially people that you can learn from, potentially people that you can, who can have an impact on your life, and so on. I would say that this strange quote that I have no idea where it originally came from, maybe the guy in question found out about it from another person himself, but it is ridiculously accurate. Mm-hmm.
I definitely agree with that. The idea of being empathetic and realizing that what you're doing isn't for you, but it's for somebody else. And if you want them to get value out of it, you have to understand what it is that their needs and wants and goals are. So that I've never heard that rhyme before, but it's fantastic. I'm gonna have to write that down and use it. So I want to thank you so much, Andre, for taking time out of your busy day to chat with me. If the listeners would like to hear more and see more about what you're working on, what is the best way they could do that?
First of all, thanks a lot for having me, and thanks a lot, guys, for listening. If you have any questions, feel free to send me a message, to reach out to me. You can do that by visiting youtube.com/oneminuteeconomics, and you can find an about section there where my email address is listed, or you can visit the website of my book, which is wealthmanagement2.com. which also has a contact section with a form through which you can send me a message asking me questions if you have concerns or stuff like that. So if there's anything I can be of help with, if you have questions about economics, if you'd like me to clarify some of the things we've chatted about on this podcast, please send me a message, and I promise that I'm going to do my best to answer as soon as I can.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I will put those in the show notes. So they can just click through. But again, thank you so much for your time, Andre. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Yuri. Have an awesome day.
Thank you. You too. Take care. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Advance Your R podcast. If you liked this episode, please go into iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. And while you're there, hit the subscribe button so that every single time I release a new episode, it will go directly to you without even thinking about it. If you're interested in hearing older episodes, please go to advanceyourart.com, where you can find the catalog of everything I've done so far, as well as contact information and projects I'm working on. Thank you again, and have a great day.